are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Before the sensational cases of Amanda Knox and Casey Anthony, before even Lizzie Borden, there was Polly Bodine, the first American woman put on trial for capital murder in our nation's debut media circus. On Christmas night, December 25, 1843, in a serene village on Staten Island, shocked neighbors discovered the burnt remains of 24-year-old mother Emmeline Houseman and her infant daughter Anne Eliza. In a perverse nativity, someone bludgeoned to death a mother and child in their home and then covered up the crime with hellfire. When an ambitious district attorney charges Polly Bodine, Emmeline's sister-in-law, with a double homicide, the new penny press explodes. Polly is a perfect media villain. She's a separated wife who drinks gin, commits adultery, and has had multiple abortions. Between June 1844 and April 1846, the nation was enthralled by her three trials in Staten Island, Manhattan, and Newburgh for the Christmas murders. After Polly's legal dream team entered the fray, the press and the public debated not only her guilt, but her character and fate as a fallen woman in society. Public opinion split into different camps over her case. Edgar Allan Poe and Walt Whitman covered her case as young newsmen. P.T. Barnum made a circus out of it. James Fenimore Cooper's last novel was inspired by her trials. The Witch of New York is the first narrative history about the dueling trial lawyers, ruthless newsmen, and shameless hucksters who turned the Polly Bodine case into America's formative tabloid trial. An origin story of how America became addicted to sensationalized reporting of criminal trials. The Witch of New York vividly reconstructs an epic mystery from old New York and uses the Bodine case to challenge our system of tabloid justice of today. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Witch of New York, The Trials of Polly Bodine and the Cursed Birth of Tabloid Justice, with my special guest, crime historian and author, Alex Hordes. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Alex Hordes.
Hello, Dan. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this book, The Witch of New York.
Thank you.
Let's get to how you came to be the author of this book. Maybe give us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So my first book was about the rise of the New York Mafia. I had started it in law school, and I had been considering a second book. I knew I wanted to do a trial of some kind, and I came across this New York Times article, sort of by happenstance, about this bonkers case about on Staten Island about a woman who was accused of murdering her sister-in-law and niece over Christmas 1843. And Edgar Allan Poe had written about it. P.T. Barnum had made this controversial exhibit out of it. It had captivated not only New York, but the country. And every time I started, you know, research it, the story just got better and better. And there were things that the New York Times article hadn't even touched on. I discovered Walt Whitman was involved in it later. And best of all, nobody had written a full-length narrative nonfiction history of this case, which I contend is the biggest case that had yet to receive a nonfiction history treatment on.
Let's get to this incredible story. But first, let's get the background of this Polly Bodine. She's a former Mary, and explain this nickname of Polly for Mary. This Mary Houseman and her family had oyster boats. Tell us a little bit about their background and them coming to the U.S. in the first place, and Mary Polly Houseman growing up.
Sure. So the Housemans, as they were known originally, were one of the very earliest settlers in New York. They were Dutch Protestants, Calvinists, and they had arrived originally in 1650, and they first settled in New York, but then they moved to Staten Island. Staten Island tended to sort out people like this, like the very most sort of mercantile, ambitious people would stay in New York. Those who were more interested in farming and later oystering would stay in Staten Island. They predate the founding of the United States. They're literally one of the founding families, the Housemans. Her father, Abraham, which later became Houseman, Americanized to Houseman, was a wealthy man. He got very lucky. He had bought land on a rich deposit of trap rock, which was very good for construction, just as Manhattan was going through a building boom. And so he sold that land for what's the equivalent of $1.2 million. On top of that, he had a thriving oyster business. New York was going through an oyster craze. They loved oysters in the 1800s. So to a large extent, Staten Island was feeding Manhattan. Oysters was its main line of business. Polly's husband, her father, her brothers, they were all in the oystering business. So as you can imagine, she's part of this old line Dutch clan. And at the time, Staten Island is made up of French Protestants, Dutch Protestants, and then later English settlers. And she's one of the oldest, most respected clans, most wealthy clans on Staten Island. They're very close-knit, very loyal. And Staten Island is small. There's only about 10,000 people. So her name carried a lot of weight. And she knew that. And she was a bit howdy. She would say things like, "I enjoy all the pleasures of life," and, you know, because her father was wealthy. And she knew that she was a Houseman and very proud of that. Polly herself was one of eight children. She is what we now call athletic. She would, you know, row boats. She would walk enormous amounts, you know, equivalents of marathons. She would walk, you know, in a couple of days across Staten Island in New York. She was called bold and determined by the press. And when I first read that, I thought, oh, it's a compliment. And that was not a compliment back then. A bold and determined woman was considered dangerous and bad. And so she is become sort of an isolated person on Staten Island. Her marries very young to this what we now call, you know, a drunken sailor, basically. He was called vicious and intemperate, which is, you know, 1800s speak for he was an abusive drunk. And right. She had two kids at a very young age, and he basically fritters away all their money. He abuses her. So eventually she goes and moves back in with her father and her two young children. And when that happened, divorce is very, very difficult then. The main ground, the only real ground for most people was adultery. Very hard to prove, humiliating. So she becomes this very isolated woman on an island full of gossips. There are rumors that she's having an affair. There's rumors that she has, quote, bad character. They're really judging her as a woman as it begins. And so she starts working she tries to work in New York for a while. Her son becomes an apothecary apprentice for a man named George Waite. So that's how I describe her.
Now, you also you haven't mentioned that she becomes one of the prettiest girls. She's considered one of the prettiest girls on Staten Island as well.
She is considered a pretty young maiden. And it's interesting, her description of her looks change throughout the newspaper coverage. And we see that with some women today. you know, high profile defendants. You know, some they say, well, she was originally beautiful. Some say she's the most beautiful maiden ever. She had kind of blue eyes, black hair, kind of angular face, athletic, and was considered attractive. I think the consensus is as a younger woman, she's considered very attractive, but then their appearance changes as the accusations start to fly.
Right. Now you talked about
I should say you had asked earlier, the way that she gets Polly, and I didn't know this before, but her, you know, her maiden name, her birth name is Mary Houseman, but Mary Polly was a common nickname opposite of, it would become Mary becomes Molly and then Molly becomes Polly. So I didn't know that, but Polly is a common nickname for Mary.
Now you talked about that she is one of eight children of Abraham and his wife, and that one of her favorite sibling was George, and George had built a cottage for his newlywed wife, Emmeline Van Pelt. And 1842, George and Elizabeth were blessed with a daughter named Anne Eliza. So tell us more about George and also the proximity to all these houses in this area of the family.
Yes. Yeah, so she lives in a place called Granite Village. It's now known as Graniteville. It was about 250 odd people or so. A lot of them related. She lived literally next door to her brother, George Houseman, and her sister-in-law, Emmeline, and her niece, Anne Eliza. She actually delivered Anne Eliza, her niece, when the doctor was on the other side of the island and
right.
She had to be delivered. She was also, you know, very close to them. Her brother is an oysterman, like many. So he's gone a lot. He goes away, for weeks. And in his absence, Emmeline is very timid, as she's described. And so she likes to have usually Polly's daughter, but sometimes Polly too, stay overnight with them. And so that was their arrangements. And they were, by all accounts, seemed to get along very well and very loving.
What was the living arrangements? Who was she living with at her father's at that time?
So she was living with her parents. Her parents, as was common back then, she was living with her parents and her daughter. Her son later becomes an apprentice in Manhattan. And she's essentially living off of her parents. She does have a difficulty finding work, or she tried to establish a school, but it failed. And you know, you can't help but wonder if it had something to do with her reputation. And so she's essentially living off of her parents. She did work a little bit in Manhattan, have occasional jobs there. She would go in. She would actually take Emmeline into Manhattan. I always love this image of this younger, naive girl, woman, you know, being escorted around town, kind of shown Manhattan by Polly.
What was the state of journalism before we get to this eventful night, Christmas night, 1843? What was the state of journalism at that time?
So this is the birth of the penny press. The penny press starts in the 1830s and it really gets going in the 1840s. The major papers were the New York Sun, which is run by Moses Yale Beach, who later founded the Associated Press. His rival, James Gordon Bennett, an infamous man. Walt Whitman used to compare him to a reptile that leaves slime as he walks along.
Wow.
He recommended that women have priests as lovers because they're purer and they're better lovers. You know, bigot of every stripe. You know, a really nasty, nasty man by iconoclast, but a very good writer. And the state of the newspapers were, the penny press, as they were called, were new. They're different. They had newspapers before, but they were, you know, mostly party organs, or they were like these merchant journals, which were boring. And so they had this, their idea was, you know, we're going to send reporters to sit on the overnight desk in the court system and report these little court cases as dramas. And people loved it. People loved it. They bought it like crazy. And it was originally sort of for the working class or common person, but the wealthy people started to read it too. And you can see, like, Philip Hone, the former mayor, said everybody condemns it, but then they secretly have a copy at home. And they love this. It's salacious. It's really our nascent tabloids. They would talk about political scandals, sexual innuendo, and people loved it. They ate it up. And so they're thriving, but they're always looking for that next big case. There were two big cases before Polly's case that got their kind of juices flowing. Mary Rogers, the mysterious cigar girl that Edgar Allan Poe wrote about. The other was Helen Jewett, who was a prostitute who was murdered in a brothel. And James Gordon Bennett did really controversial things. He would go into the crime scene, somehow get in, the body was still there, and he described the body in almost erotic detail. And it was very popular. And so then this new case comes along involving this double homicide over Christmas, this time for the first time by a woman. This is the first woman that's put on trial for capital murder in like a media circus. There had been a couple isolated cases, but nothing like this. This is a whole other level of intrigue.
Let's get to that fateful night, Christmas night, 1843 in Granite Village, and the home of Captain George Houseman. Some villagers see the house on fire. So tell us what happens with this fire.
So they rush into the house, and it is this really intense fire in the kitchen. When they get in there, and after they put it out, this bucket brigade's resin that was melted is dropping down. All the, you know, the walls are blackened. It's a horrific kind of scene, ashes all over the place. But they think that there's nobody there because Captain Houseman was away at sea, and they were told that Emily and Ann Eliza had gone to see relatives. Well, as they're poking around and kind of putting the last embers out, one of the men finds a body, and it's bent in half like a hoop. And they originally, due to the fire, he originally thought it was like a sheep. And then he's horrified and he runs out when he learns it's a body. And then even worse, next to Emmeline Houseman is Ann Eliza, the infant, about 18 months old. There's evidence that they had been bludgeoned before the fire. Emmeline has these defensive wounds, these deep cuts down to her bone on her left forearm. And so it's fairly clear there was some kind of confrontation. And on her right arm, there is a tight handkerchief that's tied in a sailor's knot. So people are wondering what happened. And beyond that, people are just stunned, horrified. Who would kill a mother and child over Christmas in this, and then leave them in this hellfire to cover up the crime? And so it immediately becomes a huge case. James Gordon Bennett of the Herald jumps all over this case.
Now tell us how police proceed with the evidence that they have found so far, and who is their likely suspect and why?
So Polly was the last person seen alive with Emily. She stayed overnight on the Saturday, December 23rd. She becomes a suspect in large part at the beginning because of her character. People thought, said she had poor character. They somehow blamed her for the marriage. You know, there were rumors about an affair. And so she was put on trial initially, in part for her as a woman, essentially. But then evidence starts to gather. There is a pawnbroker that says that he saw somebody that looked like Polly, that was Polly, pawn the goods on Christmas Day, a good like 9 hours before the bodies are discovered. And there's no question that these are Emmeline's goods. They're like these silver spoons. There's a gold watch and a chain. And it could not have been stolen afterward because it was 9 hours before. And so the question is, who would have access, before the bodies are even discovered, to these valuables? And people assume it's Polly. They think it's Polly. And the other pawnbrokers come forward. They say as well that it's Polly. She came to them on Christmas Day and gave a name of Ellen Henderson of Bergen, New Jersey, which, curiously, I might note, I don't know, I could not ever prove this, but she also, her family did pass through Bergen. Lived briefly in Bergen. I have no idea there's a connection, but in any event, and so other evidence is gathered. There's a note that seems to be like an alibi, in which she's saying, she writes to George Waite, her lover, and says, "You must tell them that I was with you all Christmas." Well, she wasn't. She doesn't have an alibi for Christmas night. So on Christmas Day, she comes to Manhattan to see her son, Albert, and her lover, although her son didn't know that George Waite was her lover. She's 8 months pregnant with his son and unborn son. And so then they start to look hard at her. And pretty soon the villagers come to her. Her brother-in-law says, "Polly, everybody thinks that you did it." She also had been pointed, the finger had been pointed at her by the bereaved father of Emmeline, who said at the funeral, during the burial, he said, "Polly is the murderess." And so the press, but this is before she's even like arrested, James Gordon Bennett is saying she's the murderess. She goes on this chase, this crazy low-speed chase, in which she's 8 months pregnant, and she leaves on the Friday after Christmas and takes off, walks essentially the width of Staten Island, then the length of Manhattan, all the way to Harlem and back, the equivalent of essentially a marathon. And she eventually gives herself up. Other evidence then starts to mount against her.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, let's talk about her lover, George Waite. And you talked about this letter that seems to provide, she wants to have an alibi provided by her lover, George. But also tell us what he really was known to be selling. And that led to her tarnished reputation, to say the very least.
So George Waite is an apothecary. He has a store at 252 Canal Street, which is just off of Broadway, which is the most fashionable street, you know, west of the Champs-Élysées. And it during this time, abortion becomes a very hot issue because increasingly middle class and upper class women are using abortifacients to kind of control their lives. So these herbs and remedies, and today we call him a pharmacist, but that's not quite what he would have been perceived as back then. It would have been, there's a slight, you know, slightly nefarious reputation to apothecaries because they would stock things, you know, that potentially use as poison. They would stock abortifacients. He almost certainly was selling abortifacients that close to Broadway. And there were rumors that got out that she had had upwards of 6 or 7 abortions through George Waite's abortifacients. Because what happens is that when she's arrested, she gives birth in the jail cell. She has a stillbirth in the jail cell. So the press just explodes. And now they have their opportunity to get into her sex life. And so they have these details about her bedroom. They have, you know, these rumors. You know, is it true? It's very, very hard to prove that. But Penny Press said, other than their trial transcripts, which are very reliable, you know, when it came to rumors, they'd run almost anything. They also print a false confession. The son buys a hoax confession, just outright buys and just runs it. The other newspapers jump all over it, and then it falls apart soon. But then people see this. So I always think it's amazing that they were carrying on this secret relationship. They didn't let their family member know in December. And by January, the entire nation knows because the newspaper coverage spreads and spreads. And they put their pictures, their illustrations, these woodcut illustrations in the Herald. And he comes out okay. He's kind of, you know, the equivalent of what we call a playboy today. A sporting man is the word that they would use. Deeply in debt, behind on the rent. She looks like this old witch. She's a 33-year-old woman, but when you look at the woodcut illustration of her, she looks like she's in her 70s. These deeply etched wrinkles. Right. She's kind of drowning in this black ink, with her hands kind of, you know, folded, and she looks creepy. And, you know, I think that was intentional. James Gordon Bennett understood you could sell a lot of copies of newspaper if you had a good villain. And she made for a very good villain, especially back then. If you can imagine, she was still married. She had never gotten divorced from her first husband. She couldn't. And so she was having an adulterous affair. She had, you know, pregnant with another man's child that was not her husband. You know, the Scarlet Letter comes out around this time. Nathaniel Hawthorne is sort of commenting on how severe adulterers were treated. Basically, they didn't use this term explicitly. Essentially, they were slut-shaming her, what we would say today. She's this promiscuous, awful, evil woman, a witch-like figure. Not that she practiced magic, although there were allusions to her possibly poisoning Emmeline, and then she used these, you know, herbal abortifacients. But she was essentially this witch archetype, this evil woman, you know, with strong sexual overtones, you know, oldish, but somehow still sort of attractive and evil, essentially, and treacherous and dangerous to men.
You say that George Wade is depicted far less harshly than Polly Bodine, certainly. But there are items or an item found in his home which casts doubt on his innocence. And what is he charged for subsequently?
Yes. So the police search the apothecary and they find this coral bead necklace that belonged to Ann Eliza. She had been seen wearing it. And so he claims he has no idea how it got there. His theory was Polly, you know, stole the items and brought them to the place. However, the police think there is more than that. They don't charge him with murder because he does have a very good alibi. Albert Bodine says that her son said that George Waite was with him at the apothecary all through Christmas, including on Christmas night during the fire. So he has a good alibi, but he has, you know, this letter that he received from Polly. Makes it sound like they're potentially in cahoots. He finds, you know, this item of the child. So the stolen goods were in his apothecary. And so they charge him with being, and on top of that, there are these kind of questionable, mysterious conversations he has with Polly in front of Albert, and where he basically tells Albert to go away. They have something important to talk about and is very brusque with Albert when he asks him, you know, basic questions about where she's. You know, she left on Christmas night, you know, before right. dinner. And Albert says, well, why are you leaving? It's Christmas night. And he says, I'm going to see Elizabeth Strange. The police go to Elizabeth Strange, her acquaintance in Manhattan. She said, I haven't seen Polly in 6 months. So she lies to her son about where she was on Christmas. And, you know, tying back to George Waite, when he asks this, George Waite tells him, be quiet, essentially, you know, stop asking her questions. And so their theory, I think their working theory was that he certainly was involved in the pawning of the goods, is their theory. And so they charge him with being accessory after the fact. Then Polly and George start pointing fingers at each other. Polly's family outright says George Waite is the murderer. Polly's innocent. George Waite says, I had no idea how the goods got in here. I'm completely innocent. I can't really say. He doesn't say whether Polly's innocent. And so these erstwhile lovers now are on different sides of a murder case.
Now let's talk about the depiction of the jail. You talked about the depiction of Polly Bodine as looking like a witch and much older than her appearance. So it's obvious what they're trying to do. But the depiction of the jail, meanwhile, you say this jail is a hellhole. And so let's talk about how they get to the attorney Graham from their initial choice of attorney and why they chose this attorney Graham for the defense.
Sure. Yeah. So these prisons were hell holes. I mean, they would have mortality rates, you know, somebody told me, a historian who looked into this, of, you know, upwards of, you know, 60-70% of prisoners would just die in prison of sick, wow. You know, various sicknesses. So these were hell holes, rats, you know, it was cold. There was no heat. To, you know, hardly any heat to speak of. There might have been like a little stove in the better ones. You know, the foods were left over, moldy. And so she doesn't, you know any other lawyer than this guy named Roderick Morrison. The way that she knows him is Roderick Morrison was the attorney for her former husband, Andrew Bodine, who, as he lost his mind, essentially married another woman. And then that woman ends up dead. In this kind of shanty that they were in. He's initially a murder suspect, but they can't prove that case. They can't essentially prove the cause of death. And so they charge him with bigamy. And so Polly says, well, that's the only attorney that she knows is Roderick Morrison, who used to be the Staten Island district attorney. So he normally would have been a good defense lawyer. The problem is he's never dealt with the media, the press beasts of Manhattan. And she's getting hammered day after day. They're just roasting her, you know, saying she's the murderess. They would hang her without judge or jury was one of the lines that was quoted. Her family is quite wealthy. And so they get the wherewithal to go to a man named David Graham Jr., a brilliant attorney. And what he had just defended a woman who had stabbed somebody, her former lover, on Astor Hotel. And he got a not guilty verdict, even though there was no doubt that she stabbed him, but the jury kind of nullified it, the case. And what he understood was two things. First of all, he knew procedural law. He was the expert. He wrote the book on it. And even more important, he understood the press. Like, he understood that the press affected trial proceedings. So he portrays his clients in sympathetic ways. The great defense lawyer Clarence Darrow once said that his basic technique was get the jury to somehow empathize or sympathize with your client and then find an excuse for them to find a not guilty verdict. And so David Graham did this. He portrays Polly as a fallen woman. You know, she's the victim of this rake, George Waite. She's the one who's forced to have an abortion by him. She's the one who's gets caught up in this media firestorm. And we could talk about P.T. Barnum as well, role in this as well. And so she becomes a fallen woman that he can try to portray sympathetically. It's very high risk, of course, but he doesn't have an option at this point because he's defending someone who's accused of murdering a young mother and child.
Now tell us again, for fans of this show, they know that this is the phenomena of people being interested in true crime is not new at all. So tell us what the reaction is from people, especially when we're talking about the trial itself, which opened June 24th, 1844.
So the people are completely absorbed by this trial. They're fascinated by the human drama. It's, you know, completely also hyped up by the Herald and the Sun. And James, they use every opportunity. This, you know, there's a sexual drama as well. There's the scandal with that. And in a way, it's almost like a public stoning of Polly. They love to vilify her, you know. And so they are following this case daily. The press does this daily coverage. These very good early reporters basically were doing transcripts, which was a new thing at the time. Of each day of trial. And so then these new editions would come out and it would blanket all of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Staten Island, and people would just be absorbed by it. Everybody was reading about it. It was extremely hard to get a jury because everybody had heard about it. A lot of people had, you know, opinions on it. Gamblers in Brooklyn were betting on the case. You start to draw in Edgar Allan Poe starts to follow the case and he writes kind of infamously, when you think about it in retrospect, that he says the trial of Polly Bodine will take place at Richmond on Monday next and will no doubt excite much interest. This woman may possibly escape, for they manage these matters wretchedly in New York. So Edgar Allan Poe is, you know, essentially he solved the case. He thinks he solved the case. He says she's clearly guilty, but he doesn't like the authorities, the police. He thinks they bungle things. So he says, she's going to escape. P.T. Barnum then seizes on it and one-ups them all and creates this wax work for his New American Museum in which Polly is portrayed as this old vicious hag that children would say later, you know, frightened them, this exhibit. He puts it in his wax section of his museum, which is only a block from City Hall during the second trial. And opens this, you know, during the first trial in Staten Island, potentially prejudicing even more jurors. And it becomes this nationally followed case. It felt very fresh. One of the reasons I was really interested in this case and was attracted to it feels very contemporary to me. And this was back in 1844. This is much earlier than I think, you know, a lot of us realize that this tabloid justice started.
Now, let's, before we talk about the trial, we also have to talk about this Judge Edmonds, but also the power that judges had at that time, as opposed to now, in terms of cross-examination and sort of just guiding the jury during the trial itself.
Yeah, this cracks me up, and it also cracks up other lawyers who read this, because they don't realize judges at that time had a lot more authority to comment on the evidence. They would ask questions, a lot of questions, of witnesses. And then during their during the jury instructions could last all day long. As the judge goes through the evidence, the judge will say what he found was persuasive, what is not. You could never do that today. You would have all kinds of appellate error, and it would be considered to prejudice the case because the judge is this authority figure. But that's how it was done back then. Judges had to be more in control. It was hard to keep kind of juries even together. They didn't have like a lot of, you know, like fancy hotels with sequestration. So they wouldn't, this cracked me up too, they wouldn't feed the jurors until they'd reached a verdict normally. Judge Edmonds is an interesting person. This is at the Manhattan trial. He's actually a spiritist. He's interested in spiritism. And he also really detests the press. And so he would call out the press and said it was completely irresponsible that they would come and print false reports and you're prejudicing the case. He got death threats throughout this, in part because of the tabloidish press.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. So let's go to the trial and tell us how they try to overcome all the incriminating evidence that Pauli Bodine faces. Tell us how they try to overcome that evidence at trial by David Graham.
So David Graham understands that there is quite a bit of circumstantial evidence, but there is nothing direct. There's nobody that says, I saw Pauli did this, or even I saw Pauli do it shortly afterward. And so he starts to counter it, I would say, three main ways. The first thing he does, as I mentioned, he sets it up to portray her very sympathetically. So he asked her sister to talk about the abusive marriage that she had been in. They start to point the finger at George Waite. They try to portray her as a victim. So there's this theme running through it. She's this fallen woman. The next thing that he does is viciously attacks the witnesses against them. He uses blatantly anti-Semitic attacks on the pawnbrokers who happen to be Jewish. It was not uncommon for just various historical reasons that the pawnbroking profession was in large part, but not, by no means entirely, or even the majority likely, were Jewish. And so he just deploys these terrible anti-Semitic tropes to the point he offends the judge even. But he would say, when it came to the life of a Christian woman, I would not trust the word of a pawnbroking Jew. And he says they're just in it for the reward money and they're liars. And, basically they're fences as pawnbrokers. There was some stolen goods that went through pawn shops. There's no doubt about it. But there's absolutely no evidence that the Gentile brokers, did anything any differently. And, a lot of the times the pawnbrokers were very good witnesses for the prosecution. Because they were they could really evaluate an individual to see if they were trustworthy, to see if the goods were stolen or not. But he viciously attacks all these different witnesses throughout the case. He pokes holes. He tries to sow doubts there. And then I would say the third prong is they completely throw off the timeline of the prosecution. So the prosecution says there was a witness in town. I mean, Jane Taylor, and she says that she heard screams coming on Saturday, December 23rd, which is the night that Pauli's over there. Unfortunately for the prosecution, the defense asks her, isn't it true you believe in ghosts? And she says, well, I'm not sure. I haven't seen one in 3 or 4 months. And so people laugh at this. And so her credibility is damaged. And then they put on the Houseman family. The ranks close here. And this is where you see the Dutch clans just closing ranks. So her sister testifies that, in fact, she had stayed over there. Her name was Carolyn Van Nam, had stayed over with Polly over Christmas holidays to help with the cooking and cleaning. And Polly stays with her on Christmas Eve. She says that she saw Emmeline alive on December 24th, Christmas Eve day, during the day. So that upends the prosecution's timeline because they had pegged the time of death to December 23rd. Then Matilda Rourke, who is a 14-year-old who lives across the way, you know, a good 200 yards away, 250 yards away, she's the niece actually of both Polly and Emmeline. She calls them Aunt Polly, Aunt Emmeline. She says that she saw from 250 yards away, she saw Emmeline alive based on how her arms swung and that she was taller than Polly, Emmeline. So they're, you know, they disrupt the timeline. Then her parents come in. They say Polly had all the money she needed. There was no motive. The motive is a weak point in the prosecution case because while the items have some value, it's less than today would be $1,000. Is that really enough to kill your sister-in-law and your niece? You know, I have a theory. We can talk about it later. But they attacked the movie. Said, why would you? Everyone said that they loved her, each other, and that she delivered Anna Liza. Would you really kill somebody over such a small amount of money? Then the prosecution tries to counter that. They bring in a pawnbroker, a Gentile pawnbroker this time. And he says that actually Polly had been pawning items regularly all throughout, including 1843. So maybe she wasn't so independent and maybe she had to get money. George Wade is deeply in debt. So that is considered a motive. It's a double-edged sword because the prosecution doesn't want them to say he's the murderer, but it kind of hints at a motive that Polly was trying to help him.
After this sensationally covered trial by, you say, the tabloid press now, the emerging tabloid press, the judge frames it to the jury that it's either murder, premeditated murder, or manslaughter. And then the jury goes to deliberations, and then they have a holdout. Tell us about this holdout and what's the result of him being a holdout in this first trial.
So the juror, James Decker, is this prosperous farmer in Granite Village. Actually, he knew Polly and the family. He's an eccentric. He initially refuses to take the juror's oath, and the judge threatens to throw him in contempt in the jail cell. And he says, well, I paid for the jail cell through my taxes. And then, you know, he refuses to then, you know, when he's actually is sworn in, you know, he makes all kinds of complaints and all this. I think that, you know, the prosecution made a mistake by keeping him on and not striking him preemptorily. But right. I think they were running out of jurors. It was nearly impossible. They were literally hunting men down, like behind haystacks and stuff, because no one wanted to serve on this. Everybody had an opinion. They had to like lock the doors of the courthouse to keep jurors in, prospective jurors. He then truly bizarre situation. He's literally a runaway juror. As the 11 other jurors are want to vote to convict, he's the lone holdout. And so he literally jumps outside off of the courthouse on the window during the night. The sheriff has to hunt him down and get him back in there. This would normally today, you know, result in a mistrial because it's just so prejudicial. But again, they had to get this case done. It was just so hard to get a juror. So they keep him on. He continues to hold out. It's days now. And you think about it, you know, they're in this like this smelly little juror room. You know, it's not air conditioned. It's hot. And they are just miserable. And they say, we cannot reach a verdict. And then they ask him later, one of the defense lawyers comes up and says, why did you vote not guilty? Because they know that there's going to be another trial. And so this is valuable. This is what lawyers do today after they want to try to find out what the jurors think. And he said, well, I would not render any verdict on circumstantial evidence. That is, not unless it was in the fourth degree. And they asked him, well, what is in the fourth degree evidence? And he said, four eyewitnesses who swear that they saw the act committed. And when you think about that, that's not circumstantial. It's direct evidence. Mm-hmm. It's virtually impossible. Very few cases have four eyewitnesses that saw it. And so that was his legal gibberish. Walt Whitman later claims that he was squeamish about the death penalty, but there's really no direct evidence of that. He just was this eccentric guy that made the first case end up in a hung jury.
Let's talk about the next trial that necessitates another trial. So you talk about the Manhattan trial. What is the difference, and what does a person like P.T. Barnum do at the onset of this trial?
So I find this supreme irony. So the press had so prejudiced potential jury pools that they couldn't find a neutral jury on Staten Island. So they transfer it to Manhattan, the belly of the beast, where right. these newspapers are all headquartered, and which there's even higher, readership of. And so it becomes this social event, essentially. They later compare it to like theater. All these upper class women dressed in these very colorful hoop dresses, fill the courtroom. They have a near riot on the first day because people are trying to get in until the sheriffs have to like literally beat them off. They eventually settle down. It's just this social madhouse. Like they're all gossiping about the case. They're talking about the case. They're giving their opinions on it. It becomes sort of a place to be seen. It had already attracted people like Edgar Allan Poe. Whitman had started to follow it. He saw Pauly on the street at one point. And then P.T. Barnum gets in on the act. So he creates, this awful, hideous waxwork, essentially portraying Pauly as this monstrous witch-like figure. Children said, they would have nightmares about it later on. It was really scary. And it was only a block from City Hall. Today, Barnum is considered this kind of lovable rogue, but what he did was monstrously awful. He used to, in fact, use those words. He would say, I need more monsters in my show, in his letters to other people. And so he was trying to sell tickets. He was actually against the death penalty, and when he was in the legislature, he opposed it. But he jeopardized her right to a fair trial while she was on trial, facing the death penalty. And so I have a very different view now of P.T. Barnum. I think that he was an opportunist and quite mean-spirited at times.
So now what we have is the trial itself and the result of that trial. You say that the defense puts on an honorable case, remarkable case, but to no avail, but also that David Graham realizes that as the trial proceeds, that there are appealable issues involved in that trial and perpetrated by Judge Edmonds. So tell us about the verdict of the trial and then the appeal process and the issues that they win in that appeal.
So it was a very long trial by those standards. Most murder trials would be at most 2 or 3 days. You couldn't keep jurors together. This one went, over 5 weeks. The prosecution went all out. It gathered anybody had any glimpse of Pauly and creates this timeline, to show that she had, likely pawned, had pawned there by their theory, had pawned the items before the victims were dead and then has no alibi for Christmas. In any event, they have an early forensics battle, which I thought was interesting. The defense could hire its own forensic witness, which was unheard of at the time, but he could try to contest the medical evidence about what was the cause of death. But the jurors, and I always find this extraordinary, it was held in City Hall in New York, which is obviously not air conditioned. It's a beautiful building with originals of the founding fathers, paintings and all that. But it's extremely hot, and they're sleeping on pine benches overnight for 2 nights. They're just losing their minds. It was originally split, and then they're down to one, and then the one flips and says, I'll vote for it. And so the vote is guilty of murder, but with a recommendation of mercy. And the former mayor of New York had speculated that was a compromise verdict because they didn't want to see a woman hang. There was also squeamishness. There was a big, believe it or not, there was a big anti-death penalty movement at this time. It wasn't the majority, but a significant number of people, including Walt Whitman, were against it. And to hang a woman, a lot of people wouldn't go there. They wouldn't do that. But so she looks doomed because, in fact, the sentence for first-degree murder, there is no such thing as life sentence in those times. That's not how the prisons were really built. You know, it was hanging. And so she is facing gallows that summer. This is where George Wade kicks in. He was planting all these seeds of potential error throughout the trial. And the judge was intelligent, but he was new and he was a little arrogant, stubborn. And so he made, you know, and in fairness, that nobody had really experienced a trial like this with this much publicity. But the main issue really was the prejudice to the jurors. He had limited the defense to asking voir dire questions. Basically, you could only ask, have you made up your mind about this case? And right. David Graham argued, that's not enough in a case like this. With all of this media coverage, and the New York Supreme Court understood this because they make references to like papers in their decision, the newspapers, and they probably read the case in the newspapers, so they know about all this prejudice. And the idea is like, look, you don't know if you're prejudiced, and you're not going to just admit that. A lot of people won't admit that, so you have to be able to ask questions like, well, what did you read? You know, did you form any opinions on that? You know, do you think that it will have any influence on you? You know, what do you think? And so that's what we have, at least in New York State, why we have these long voir dires then later on and later elsewhere, is because you have to be able to ask more questions to ferret out possible prejudice.
Right.
That was one of the main issues. There were a lot of other issues. For example, he at one point says, the judge says, well, why didn't the woman put on character, you know, evidence of her good character? Well, that's not her burden to do that.
Right.
Yes. And so he rules on most of the appellate issues and grants the Supreme Court grants a new trial. They are unable, though, to get a new trial in Manhattan because it is impossible. They went through 4,000 prospective jurors over a course of 3 weeks in Manhattan. I cannot imagine a jury selection that long. You know, just excuse. It made an opinion. Yes, I have. What do you think? I'm guilty. I don't think she's guilty. You know, I'd heard talk about this. And the jury pool, it was kind of the bottom of the barrel at this point then. They were like, had to deal with people who had like criminal records, you know, recently. And so they eventually give up on Manhattan and it gets transferred to Newburgh, New York, in upstate New York.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, you say that the Newburgh trial, it seems that from the press itself, that the public is swayed somewhat in favor of Pauli Bodine by this time. Can you explain?
Yeah, so the tide turns because people end up being disgusted by the press coverage. They, you know, think it ends up being very unfair. And also Pauli is the one who's alive. The victims are dead. So Pauli is alive, so she looks, you know, catatonic when she goes to trial. It's been over 2 years now in these miserable prisons. Walt Whitman said he predicted that she wouldn't live through the third trial. Wow. And so people start to become sympathetic towards her. It's very ironic. You know, the New York Herald, James Gordon Bennett, who called her a murderess and very much wanted her convicted, his prejudicial coverage backfires on him. The local press, then, they have their own miniature press war, and they kind of compete with each other on who can be most supportive of Pauli. The town kind of splits. Some people, you know, go stay at this one hotel, the other go to this other hotel. You see these social divisions that you see today with tabloid justice, where it kind of divides society and people take up sides. You see that happening. It was Orange County House in the United States Hotel was the divisions. And so there also is this pamphlet. I never see anything this salacious before. It's called The Early Life of Pauli Bedain. It's anonymous so that Pauli couldn't sue them for defamation. And it makes up this elaborate mythology of her early life and is sold on the streets of Newburgh. And people buy it, but then they're disgusted by it. Because it says essentially, you know, she had all going up and down the East Coast, having affairs, wrecking families, having all these abortions. And then the worst part was on page 32, there are these purported illustrations of the hairs of the seven children that she had killed in infancy. And essentially, and now, you know, the witch figure is basically complete because she is now portrayed as a baby killer, essentially, who goes around killing her own children. And it just so disgusts people and they get so turned off. Also, the prosecution at this point, you know, witnesses are falling away. They're not up for these vicious cross-examinations. It's in upstate New York. It ends up being, you know, only 8-day trial instead of, you know, the nearly 5-week, you know, over 5-week trial that they had before. And so they start losing key witnesses. They lose, for example, Catherine Jane Henry. She was on the ferry boat on the day after Christmas. Pauli comes at 6 a.m., orders a gin, looks haggard, and then sits around for 2 hours and then kind of sits in the back of the ferry where nobody can see her. And she said, I thought it was just delightful that a woman would come on board and order gin. Well, unfortunately for them, though, she's an African-American woman. And although she, you know, the press agreed she was credible, there's no evidence on no sign that she appears in the third trial. And I suspect it's because I'm not sure she could even get a room in Newburgh at the time. And so, you know, they lose the other pawnbroker, the quote Christian pawnbroker. He doesn't, you know, he's not referenced. And so the defense wears down the prosecution. They start to poke holes. And look, there are problems with the prosecution case. You know, the motive is very weak. You know, they have this whole alternative scenario where they saw, you know, her sister and niece supposedly saw her alive the day afterwards. You know, the pawnbroker witnesses, although I will say, I do believe they were telling the truth. The authorities had made a mistake because they had brought them down to the jail cell and basically pointed out Pauli and said, that's the suspect, that's her, isn't it? Like, you can never do that today. It would be considered unduly suggestive. But, you know, the defense made a big deal about that. So there were holes, there were problems in the prosecution case. But then the Newburgh jury come back, and they also had these great local lawyers, And they had this local guy named, you know, Colonel Brown. And the prosecutor was fed up because this other attorney had been just attacking New York City. Basically, they put New York City on trial. All, you know, Pauli's the victim of New York City somehow. You know, these evil abortionists, and then, you know, these Irish gangs. They have this Irish gang theory that said came up and murdered them. There were a couple of witnesses that said they saw a strange man and woman, but, you know, a gang. I mean, but anyway, they played on these gangs. And so then he finally says, you know, his name is Ambrose Jordan. He says he come to the peace from the peaceful shores of the Hudson, you know, and he said, well, why is it if, you know, this is what the prosecutor said. Why is it if New York City is such a vile place when we find that Mr. Jordan has taken his abode in New York? Because Mr. Jordan at that point was literally a Wall Street attorney, but right. He played this I'm just a country lawyer thing. And then Colonel John Brown says, oh, sir, Mr. Jordan only went to New York as a missionary. And then everybody laughs. And imagine you had to kind of be there. But the bottom line is that David Graham had made another great move, which was to get local lawyers who could really appeal to the locals.
Right. Justin.
And so they do come back with a not guilty verdict. And Pauli is acquitted.
You say that Walt Whitman uses this case and so this third trial to argue against the death penalty. tell us about the press, what their depiction is, and they're not in unison in terms of conclusion, are they?
No, they are not. So Walt Whitman, I think, is a fascinating character. This is a very, you know, he's 26 years old at this time. He's the new editor of the Brooklyn Eagle before he became a poet. And he's, you know, enthralled with the cause of the anti-gallows movement. There was a very large anti-gallows movement. It actually did repeal the death penalty in a few states, in Wisconsin, but not in New York. But it was very influential. And so he uses this case. And I do think this is kind of a form of tabloid justice. You know, he's going to project his political views of the death penalty as a way, you know, to have a not guilty verdict, essentially, because he's against the death penalty. And he says people, you know, he argues like jurors won't convict because they don't want to see a woman hanged, and that this is another good reason to repeal the death penalty. You know, he makes up this theory that the original juror in the Richmond case, in Staten Island case, made that decision because he didn't want to see her hanged. There's really not a lot of evidence for that. But he uses it just as a cause to left. I will say this, he was quite brave because the majority of people were still very much for the death penalty.
Right.
But he's just a believer. I do think there's a connection when you read his poetry, has this universality of humanity. So it's kind of a radical Christian sympathy. His position is, it doesn't matter if she's guilty. The death penalty is always wrong. Like in his poetry, he even says, I am the criminal. You know, he says, I am this person. I'm, you know, he says, you know, disreputable people. He says, I'm still a human just like they are. And so he has this radical Christian sympathy at the time. And so he does his best to argue against the death penalty. When the verdict comes out, it's fair to say the majority of the press, including the new National Police Gazette, which is sort of the first weekly tabloid, just roast this decision. You know, they say it's just an absolute disaster and catastrophe and a joke. For example, the Police Gazette said, the verdict of not guilty in this case has received the mingled sensations of horror and indignation. Every man and woman feels it, and the cheeks which blanched at the original recital of the barbarous deed now kindle with indignation that the ghost of the butchered innocence must forever wander unavenged. And other people roast the Newberg juries, and Newberg kind of gets defensive, and they try to, you know, defend their honor and all that. But it's fair to say that the majority of people, and most crucially on Staten Island, think that she got off, is what how they would say that she was guilty, and she got off.
What happens to Polly Bodine after this acquittal? Before we talk about when her demise actually happens.
So she, for reasons I don't completely understand, decides to move back to Staten Island and lives out the rest of her life on Staten Island. She lives as a recluse. Her son and her daughter move back in with her. They're very loyal and spend the rest of her life, you know, she spent with them. She lives beyond almost everybody else in this case. She just outlives everybody. Mm-hmm. There's something about those genetics, like, you know, to have gone through this harrowing experience, but she lived through all this. Everybody else died. And there's all these obituaries I quote about everybody. The Van Pelts were, you know, the parents of Emmeline were forever devastated by this. In their obituary, a family member said that, you know, their child was murdered, but the guilty person was not punished. So she is almost like this freak show, like people stop by and want to see the house where it happened, try to see her. But she dies then in 1892. Oh, and she dies only, you know, a couple weeks before none other than Lizzie Borden murder comes along. And then, yes, of course, that case becomes the new uproar.
Mm-hmm. You say that the case's precedent legally meant the jurors would be examined extensively about what they had read previously in the press. So that's what this case really heralded, but also that sensationalistic reporting on trials became a regular feature. Not surprising.
Yeah, I think that this is my bid for the birth of what I call tabloid justice. And what do I mean by that? Like, well, first of all, we project our own beliefs, our own morals, depending on where we're coming from, onto the case before we even know the facts. A lot of the time, people take up sides based on, a lot of times just stereotypes, just what they want to be true. And we see this time and again. We just see the O.J. Simpson case is a prime example. There are many, many others where people, the Americans, it happens everywhere, I think, become divided. So they project their own views on it. That's what happened in the Pauli Bedain case. Pauli, how you viewed, abortion, or how you viewed, a woman who was having an affair, how, people viewed the Jewish pawnbrokers, how people were going to stereotype everybody involved, dependent influence, how you viewed the case. Ultimately, I find it very troubling because as a lawyer, cases are supposed to be microcosms. They're about, did the prosecution prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed all the elements of this particular crime? Now we make it about, big social issues, and, it becomes the new trial that has to resolve some major issue, whether, it can be a whole range of things. It can, be justice for women. It can be, police brutality cases. It can be corruption among the police. It can be all these big issues. As a lawyer, I have to tell you, I think people are going to be disappointed if they use that as the goal, because defense lawyers can be ruthless. Prosecutors can be ruthless. The jurors make mistakes. And above all, I don't think that an individual's life should be used ultimately for some political point or some social point, no matter how important that issue may be. And we saw that here with this case. Pauli's life was endangered. I would say also, and this is kind of the most controversial and where I have, probably the hardest to defend, is that, the idea of criminal trials as popular entertainment, And so, I wrote a true crime book. My previous book was on the mafia. I think crime is a fascinating topic. I am a little squeamish, though, when it becomes entertainment, even more squeamish when people purport to make it more than entertainment. So you see this on Netflix now. Look at Netflix lately, by the way. Have you seen the offerings on true crime? It would take you months to get through that.
Sure, certainly.
And what is, just briefly, if you have a minute, I do think this is important. What happens is, I noticed this when I was writing it, it's so easy, and you're an author as well, it would be so easy to tilt a case one way or the other,
sure,
by just emphasizing this evidence, or you withhold, or you de-emphasize this evidence, or for the service of the story. So you don't come out right out and say the person's guilty, or there's all this damning evidence, because readers would get bored right away. So they withhold evidence on a lot of these shows. I don't know if it's intentional. Sometimes I think there seem to be cases where people seem intent on skewing something.
Mm-hmm.
Other cases, I think it's probably, just subconscious. I don't think that an entertainment producer can replicate a trial, because that entertainment producer, an author, or, a cable show director, doesn't have that opposing lawyer there to check them and say, well, wait a minute. Yeah. You said this, but this is, more precise, and it's not quite as bad as you make it out to be. There's not a judge, there's no rules of evidence. And so it always cracks me up. I get this vision of people sitting down, for an HBO show or something, and say, hey, honey, come on down. We're going to solve this crime together.
Yeah.
And what are the popular themes that we see? You wouldn't have much of a show if you said, well, the evidence was overwhelming, they were convicted, and I'm going to tell you all the evidence at the beginning. People wouldn't be interested. What do they get? When there's a mystery involved,
mm-hmm,
where they, there's stories of corruption, whether that's credible or not, ultimately, but the big thing, there's two stories. Either I'm going to solve the case that hasn't been solved. You see this now as a big theme. I have my doubts. Edgar Allan Poe thought you could do this. To bring it back to my book, Edgar Allan Poe, you know, he wrote about the Mary Rogers case, the cigar girl, who was this beautiful young woman who was killed. And then he purports to publicly solve the case
right
by writing about it in this serial. And he has this theory as this sailor, and he's about to name the sailor. And then it turns out that these other individuals said that they died at her tavern. So his story is ruined, you know, but he thinks you can solve cases. And the idea of the corrupt, you know, police are inept, you know, or they're corrupt. That's the other theme. And, you know, in some cases that has happened. But like, I think more than anything now, it's a storytelling device. So I'm going to solve a crime that's never been solved. The Edgar Allan Poe theory. That's a big theme. And then the other one, of course, is exonerating the innocents. Now, I definitely think that, you know, good journalism is important, and that there can be cases that people are exonerated, at least initially, through a journalistic endeavor. I really don't think a lot of these shows are great journalism, and many, many more have failed than have succeeded in doing that. Some of them, you know, I'd say The Thin Blue Line is the best example that succeeded. He did, you know, Randall Adams, they did succeed in exonerating him. But then that same director later tried with a different case and failed. And it was kind of a show about the failure. It's fascinating. But anyway, the point is that I'm very much troubled by our current true crime genre. And I would say, I'd not be a school marm, you know, because I like true crime and say, don't watch true crime. But I don't think most part it should be considered more than entertainment. And then I would say, I think there's a difference when people are still alive, too. Because when they're still family members, when the defendant is still alive, their lives are going to be harmed in a lot of cases by these excessive media shows, and especially social media. And I like to give the Boston Marathon case, in which these online sleuths, quote, you know, identified the bombers, and they were not the bombers, but their lives were turned upside down for weeks. You see this happen in other cases now. I think social media is crazy now, and people, you know, have their theories, and they attack witnesses. They do things out of context. You go on Twitter and they'll say, well, why didn't this witness say this? And it'll get like, you know, 500 likes before somebody points out, well, in fact, they said this, you know, or this is different, or it's more complicated. And so I just, you know, to me, it's like the new mob. Social media is just like a new mob, and mobs don't have a great track record when it comes to adjudicating justice.
In final with you, you say that all things can be considered at the same time. Definitely did not get a fair trial, but at the same time, she certainly could be guilty of the two murders.
Yeah, I think, you know, life is complicated. You know, it is easier, more comforting to be always on the side of angels and be, you know that you're, quote, right. But things can be complicated. As you said, you know, she can be guilty of committing a double homicide of a mother and a young child. At the same time, I think it's fair to point out that there was a lot of misogynistic attacks that jeopardized her right to a fair trial. And that is a constitutional concern and a fairness concern as well. People want to do one or the other, you know, a lot of the time. I bring up the O.J. Simpson case, for example. It is true that Mark Furman used bigoted language and was convicted of perjury.
Right.
It can also be true that O.J. Simpson murdered his wife, and Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman.
Yes.
But people don't want to accept all of that all at once. It's almost, it's just too, you know, cognitive dissonance. It's too hard. You have to always be on the side of the angels. Life is complicated. Trials are complicated.
Yes. You say that this book, this case would be a representative of tabloid justice, would forever change American law, and this case is the prime example.
Yes, I think that this case ushered in the problems that we see with tabloid justice, and what is that? Sensationalized reporting, often loose connection to the facts, rumors, innuendo, society being divided along various lines, and projecting their own beliefs and large scale issues onto what should be just be an issue of did the prosecution prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. I also don't think there's much we can do about it. I try to have some good humor about it, but I do say it's the cursed birth of tabloid justice, because with social media and the First Amendment, which I'm certainly not advocating to repeal or anything, but people are just going to have this mob mentality about cases. You see it now, see it on Twitter. And to me, it's scary. I think that the scariest part, of course, is if you're a defendant and the mob's against you, or you're a victim's family and the mob leans against the prosecution. Mobs aren't very good at determining justice, and they shouldn't be determining justice. James Gordon Bennett, the editor of the Herald, said when some lawyers talked down to him about the press, about him covering this murder trial in Boston, he said, "Well, the press is the living jury of the nation." That kind of sounds, interesting. Yeah. I think it's a horrible idea, though. The press is not the living jury of the nation. The jurors are the jury. And the idea that the press, or even worse, at least with the press, there were responsible journalists. There are responsible journalists. With social media, forget it. It's a mob. And so I fear, though, that is where we're heading. And that in high profile cases, it's going to be increasingly hard to get jurors who haven't been influenced by social media or bloggers. And it's going to be harder and harder to get juries. And I just don't like crowd certainty either. That always makes me uneasy. We've seen so many cases of injustice when everybody thought the person was guilty when they weren't. I mean, like the Central Park Five is a perfect example.
Yes.
Or conversely, somehow become attracted or convinced that there's corruption and the defendant is innocent when they may very well be guilty. And I use the other example I use is Ted Bundy, is that people forget, they don't want to remember this, but after he escaped from prison, he became a small folk hero. And there were these t-shirts saying, free Ted Bundy, because, he was, people did think he was sort of charismatic and attractive. Wow, were they wrong? A man who clubbed women to death, So I don't think that you should judge cases or people based on snippets or what you find appealing. Let the jury do their work. Let the jury do its work.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about The Witch of New York, the trials of Polly Bodine, and the cursed birth of tabloid justice. For those people that might want to find out more information about this book, could you refer us to a website, and do you do any social media?
Yes, my website is www.alexhortus.com. I am also on Twitter under my name, Alex Hortus, Alex-Hortus. You can find me there. And the book is on, is on sale in bookstores everywhere and online. And I would say it's been a real pleasure. Great questions. And I can tell that you're an author, too, because of the questions you ask, which is really refreshing and nice.
Thank you so much, Alex Hortus, for coming on and talking about The Witch of New York, The Trials of Polly Bodine, and The Cursed Birth of Tabloid Justice. You have a great evening, and thank you so much for this interview, and good night.